This episode is brought to you by Audible, the worldwide leader in audiobooks. As a listener to our podcast, you can now go to audibletrial.com/coach to receive a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial with Audible. Choose from over 180,000 books to listen to on the go or while you're relaxing. You can show your support for our podcast by going to audibletrial.com/coach to start your free trial. I'll put a link in the show notes. Just a quick note before we start the show. We're looking for stories about coaches who are doing a fantastic job encouraging their players and making the game fun. Here at Coach Calls Timeout, we understand how important that is for the development of young players and people. We want to celebrate those coaches, but it's going to take a team effort. Here's what you can do. Go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories. Nominate that coach and possibly get their story told on this podcast. Help them get the recognition that they deserve. Thanks. Here's the show. You're now in the huddle with Coach Calls Timeout, the podcast that dissects the mind of a different basketball coach every episode. We uncover what makes them successful and how their story translates to your coaching journey. Let's unlock your team's potential together. Welcome to episode 15 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. Dan Jonker here. Today's an exciting day. We're back to the original format of interviewing coaches and sharing their experiences. And we have a great guest for you, but before I share who it is, let me tell you a quick backstory. So my brother Brian does most of the interviews for the podcast and I do the editing. While I was going through this episode, I was texting Brian back and forth and I couldn't contain my excitement. There's some great things in this interview that will make you a better coach and change the way you look at some very basic things. We get into why you need to prepare for all 14 or 15 people involved in the game, not just the 10 players. We crunch some numbers on the importance of winning the first and third quarters. We talk about why you need to practice your transition game way more than you probably do, and get away from standing around in the half court during practice. Anyways, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me tell you who the guest is. Here's his resume. He played at Indiana University for Bobby Knight. He was drafted in the second round of the 1980 NBA draft by the Los Angeles Lakers. He played with Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Isaiah Thomas, Dr. J, Charles Barkley, the list goes on and on. After his playing days, he went back to coach his high school alma mater, Middletown High in Ohio, and he led them to an amazing three-year turnaround, ending with an 18-3 season. That led to assistant coaching stints in the NCAA and the NBA, and ultimately led to a head coaching role with the Toronto Raptors, where he helped lead the franchise to his first ever playoff appearance. He's coached the likes of Vince Carter, Tracy McGrady, Antonio Davis, Charles Oakley, my favorite Raptor of all time, Alvin Williams, and so many more great players. Of course, I'm talking about Coach Butch Carter. My brother Brian handles the interview. Let's get to it. Welcome to the Coach Calls Timeout podcast, episode 15. Brian Jonker here. And as Dan said in the intro, we've got a great guest for you tonight. Coach Butch Carter's with us. And Coach, thanks very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us.
No problem. I was kind of pleasantly surprised when you got a hold of me. And, to all of the coaches who try to get a hold of me, if I can help them, I try to respond and help out. So I'm very glad to do your podcast.
Okay, well, hopefully tonight a little bit of the time that you're going to spend with us will be helpful to a lot of coaches that we have that have been tuning in and excited about the things that we're doing. So you have two amongst many strengths, but two very prominent strengths, I think, that come out. One, you had always been known as a good strategist, and we're really ahead of your time in analytics. We'll talk about that in a second. But also, you're very well known for having developed young players. You're a great developer of players. What do you think makes you a good developer of players?
Well, I think that I went back and started as a high school coach. And I think all coaches, to eventually be good, there needs to be a period of time where everything they're doing is not being evaluated harshly. I really feel bad for, like giving Derek Fisher, the head coach of the New York Knicks. He had no clue how to organize himself, his practices, and so inevitably it was going to run into problems. I think the most important thing for me was that period where I was a high school coach. I had some extremely talented young guys who were 14 and 15 years old, and I learned that my 14 and 15 year olds couldn't get through the 2 hour practices with my older kids. So I think that was the first benefit that, you know, it was the perfect tsunami where I had all of this knowledge that I'd been saving up on if I ever got a talented player, what I would do. And I was able to practice that with my high school guys and see them develop, go from a team that won 13 games the first year and then become the number one team in the state the second year and lose 2 games. And so, you know, I basically, like I said, the perfect tsunami was I got these young guys who are really talented, Carter, McGrady, Alvin Williams, even Antonio Davis, and was able to take those fundamentals in which I learned on what to do, how long they should practice, the second workout, and just get them to buy into their talent.
When you talk about Vince and Tracy and player development, what difference did you notice, Vince having played, spent time in the NCAA versus Tracy coming directly out of high school? Was there a difference?
Well, there was a difference because Tracy had a big-time agency. He had Arn Tellem, and Tracy wanted everything immediately. But it was physically impossible for him to maximize his talent in a 48-minute game with 82 games a year. You know, he was might have been 185 pounds dripping wet when I first got him. And that just wasn't going to go at that time. You had Richie Miller playing the two. There were just a lot of guys. It was murderer's row at the two spot. And one of the things we did was to hide Tracy and Vince was to keep Doug Christie. And Doug did all the dirty work and had to guard a lot of top scorers at the two position and let those guys move around and have some freedom. And it worked out pretty good.
I can't even imagine. I mean, I've got the youngest team I've ever had this year. We've got 9 first-year guys right out of high school. I can't imagine. I look at those guys and I think Tracy McGrady was playing against men at that age. I don't even know how it's possible.
Well, one of the rules we put in for Tracy was that he only had to practice the first hour. He had to practice the first hour, then he had to stand beside me the rest of practice, and then he had a second workout where he had to come in and work on the shots. But the biggest problem for young guys, and which the mistake coaches make, is that, you know, I go watch and coaches stay on one end of the court for long periods of time, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour. And I think that's one of the most destructive things you can do to young players because the game goes up and down. The NBA game is Golden State average, I think, 103 possessions per game. On the low end would be Cleveland and San Antonio in the 91, 92 possessions. The Raptors are kind of right in the middle. But you're going to see that every night where really good teams and really good coaches understand that the most important play in basketball is the sprint that goes from the defensive free throw line to the offensive free throw line and opposite going the other way. The sprint that goes between the free throw line from defense to offense and offense to defense. So coaches get caught up in what they think is a magic play. And the magic play that you have to become very good at is transition. It is numerically more transition happens in basketball than any other play. It's the only thing in basketball that you're required to do on both ends of the floor.
If you want to focus on your offensive transition, yeah, how do you do that without also evaluating or you know, crushing your defensive transition?
Never stay on end of the court more than 5 minutes. So you're teaching mental quickness to your young guys. And then the other thing you do is that if you take out the ambiguity, that you tape your practices. So the most important thing a coach can do with his players is build integrity through the truth that's being transferred through communication.
That's a very, very powerful tool. I mean, you can't hide from the tape, first of all.
Correct. And what happens to guys is that they just get lazy. You know, we'll get to it later. So when I was at the University of Dayton, my head coach was Jim O'Brien, who had been with Rick Pitino for a long time. And he had this chart. It was offensive plus, offensive minus, defensive plus, defensive minus. So I would take that chart, and after every practice, I would go through and go offensive plus, offensive minus, defensive plus. And so basically what it ended up doing, it was a team evaluation, but it was an individual evaluation. So there was one thing we learned is that, like, offensively, if we put Doug Christie on the right side of the floor facing the basket and put him in pick and roll, he would never go over the screen. So that meant that we needed to put him back in two-ball dribbling so that he became comfortable with dribbling his left hand coming to the center of the court.
So this leads right into the first point I actually made, is that I believe you're ahead of your time from an analytics standpoint. Nowadays, you know, everybody talks about analytics in every sport. You know, 15, 20 years ago, you were already charting things like this and looking at it. Why did you find the analytics side, or why do you find the analytics side so intriguing?
I wanted to win.
And how did you correlate, though? I mean, how do you become ahead of the curve on this, where you realize that, hey, these numbers, this math equation here equals more W's?
Well, because here's the reality. Half the games in the NBA are lost every year, 1,230. All right? So if you divide the 1,230 in losses and 1,230 in wins, you come up with 4,615s. So those 615s are four quadrants. So what you have to do is say, what stats are in the top two quadrants? So if you're in the bottom quadrant, that means you're the one of the worst teams in the league, or the worst two or three teams in the league. If you're in the next quadrant, you're probably winning 30 games. If you can blow and get to the next of the top quadrant, but what you have to do is that everybody who talks about analytics coach, here, this is why I know I could catch him tomorrow. Analytically, in a basketball game, there are 15 people that are involved. They're running models that only have 10 players. I mean, they have 5 offensive players, 5 defensive players. Because they don't know how to evaluate the coaches, and they don't, the two coaches, the head coaches, and they don't know how to evaluate the three officials, they leave them out of the equation. So from an error standpoint, plus or minus, they are 33% off because they don't have 5 people in the model.
Is there a way you think you can fit those 5 into the model?
It's easy. There are 2 stats. If you win the first quarter and the third quarter in the NBA, you win 88% of your games. Now, that's a stat I found and created in 1998.
And so as a coach, how do you win the first and third quarter?
Preparation. How are you training your guys? Right? You have to make them understand. Like in the NBA, it was really important because they knew if they won the first and third quarter, they got the rest because they're playing 82 games.
It's easy to say, okay, guys, if we win the first and third quarter, we're gonna win the game. But what types of things do you prepare to do that?
So then you have to give them the stats that go with winning the first and third quarter. So in the last 10 years, San Antonio has been in the top 2 in winning the first and third quarter. Last year, Golden State was number 1 by far and winning the first and third quarter. That's how they were able to get to where they won 70 games.
Is some of that a byproduct of the fact that maybe their starters are better than the other starters, so the first and third quarter they're playing more minutes?
No, the issue at the end of the day is more effective. So you can basically chart out so what we did in 98 was put every player in the NBA in, like, what do they do on a per-minute basis. So when we did that, what clearly became evident was that winning teams have more energy. And the energy equated to they were more efficient. So you say, Coach, how do you chart the officials? Well, if you shoot more free throws than the other team in the NBA, you win like 75% of your games. So you want to train your guys to learn how to use both hands so that they can be more efficient to draw more fouls. You want to train them not to play with their back to the basket in the low post, because the official is trained, right, in the NBA that he can defend with an arm bar. So as long as he's allowed to defend with an arm bar, the official is mostly likely not going to call a foul. But if you teach the player to turn and face and run by the defender, the rule says that if the offensive player's shoulders get past the defensive player's shoulders, when the defensive player touches him, who's the foul on coach?
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely.
So if you go back and look at any from my guys, there are two things. We did a lot of two-ball dribbling and taught them a crossover dribble. So the problem with today's analytics and the kids that are in the analytics is that they cannot improve the process. All they can do is give the net results of the numbers.
Interesting.
Right? So he can say, hey, this is what we need to do. We need to shoot more threes. Well, you know why they're saying you got to shoot more threes is because they can't teach them to shoot twos.
Right.
So if you pulled up the list of all the guys in the NBA Hall of Fame, how many of them got there shooting threes?
And pretty much none.
Right? But now they're saying, oh, we got to shoot threes.
Well, that makes me laugh all the time because you see the stats now and you think, oh, Larry Bird won the three-point contest, great three-point shooter, this, that. And then you look and they start talking about the numbers when they're in the playoffs and stuff, and it's like Larry attempted 60 threes in a season or something, yeah. And Steph's doing that in a week.
Right. I mean, so the reality is the efficiency is directly related to the energy. Teams who have poor energy have poor records because they don't have the energy to involve the officials in a game. If you win the first quarter and the third quarter, the statistics show that the officials are more than likely to leave you alone and let you win the game because you have proven yourself out to them by the way you've played in the first and third quarter.
Do you know if any of these same things, if that holds true at the college level as well?
I've never run the stats on the college level, but we always thought at the college level you have to win the first 5 minutes of the half and the first 5 minutes of the second half.
Right.
But coach, think through it. It's kind of simple. If your backups are on the bench, there's a reason for it. They're not as good as your starters.
Correct.
So when you sub you put your subs in the game, they need to have a lead.
Yeah. Well, or you're hoping the other guy's putting his in too, and they're not as good as yours.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But what happens a lot of times in NBA, there's no philosophy on winning the first and third quarter, and now they're always putting their subs in when they're behind.
Right. Well, right? I mean, you watch everybody's, for the most part, you watch NBA games, and there's a pattern. I mean, if I watched four of a team's games, I could probably go and coach the fifth one and have the subs in almost the same time in the first and third quarter as they do.
Yep, agree.
Like there almost seems to be, I don't know. I prefer there's a certain number of guys where I know they need a certain number of minutes to start the game or to start the half. And then there's some other guys where if they got hot, maybe I leave them out there a couple extra than they normally would. But it almost feels like there isn't as much. People don't coach by feel as much.
Well, the problem that I found that I had to overcome was in your substitution pattern, you need to build some flexibility in guys being able to defend multiple positions. If you don't do that, coach, you really hurt yourself in your chances of winning. Because, like you said, you get a guy that's out there, he's hot, he scored a couple buckets, he's got a steal, got an offensive rebound, got his guy locked up. And if you can't sub someone else out, then now it's really unfair to him, but you put yourself in a bind. So what I found was when you try to go from bad team to good team, the more flexibility you have in your rotations on guys being able to play positions, and equally at the end of the game, if you need to get your best defensive team on the floor, you have the flexibility to be able to do that in your first seven guys. So coaches get caught because they preemptively haven't thought through that process. Like, what do we want to be at the end of the game? Where we want to be at? Who we want to play? And it needs to have a lot of flexibility in it because, again, the Zebras might have called fouls on one of your better defenders and he's not available.
So it's very clear that, you know, you've spent a lot of time not only thinking about it but running numbers, and obviously that's a strength of yours. And we talked about player development as a strength as well as a couple of the areas that you excel in. Our last podcast and our coach's roadmap was about being self-aware, a coach having to be self-aware. If you were to look in the mirror and evaluate yourself, where do you think that you could have improved as a coach?
One, I wish I had done such a good job, but the one thing was that I my guys were still very connected to me, and I wish I would have learned to sit down more.
Meaning?
Because they need to bump their head and grow. And I stood the whole time. So, and I'm lucky, you know, I have a voice that carries. So, you know, they're very tied to my voice. And I think in the future, if I ever coached again, I would try to disconnect from them and let them grow even more. Because I think I know what to do as a coach to get them ready. But in the long run, you've got to let them bump their head. And then when they come back to you, they're even more hungrier to digest the stuff that you need to give them.
Do you find that, I mean, I don't know how much of the international game you watch or even the Canadian game at the college and university level now because they play FIBA rules. I don't know how much of that game that you watch, but if you do, the rules of FIBA lend itself towards forcing you to let your players play like that. There isn't 150 timeouts like there is in an NBA game. You have to prepare your players to go out and play, and in a lot of situations, you have to be prepared for them so they can execute without you having to draw it up or pull them aside or call a timeout. Did you get a chance to see any of the Olympic stuff?
Yeah, I watched the Olympics and I watched the qualifying tournament. And to me, the FIBA game is more of what we in the States would call a Catholic League game. It's lower possessions. It's more effective shooters, smarter play. You get a lot of acting. And so, you know, you have to be able to catch and shoot the basketball because FIBA doesn't allow you just to bully your way in there and play 20 possessions in the low post or be an athlete all the time. So it really puts a premium on the ability to shoot the basketball. And most players aren't taught any in-between games. So if they beat their guy, there's a second guy sitting there either taking the charge or interfering with their path. So it was interesting to watch Tony Parker because he's kind of, you know, he's dominated that fake, you know, get into the lane and wiggle around, you know, be around the second guy. And Canada really struggled with that, but I agree with you. But, you know, in my mind, it's Cincinnati Moeller, Cincinnati Roger Bacon. You know, those were the Catholic GCL school that we had to play against. We always knew it was a low possession game, it was a smarter game. They were going to run flex. And, and hopefully they thought they would outscore you from the free throw line. And you'd make enough mental mistakes that they could get some momentum and win the game.
See, and I find that I actually disagree in a sense in that I find that with the shot clock and the rules now, especially in our college, if you get an offensive rebound, the shot clock only resets to 14 seconds.
Correct.
So they're asking you to try and play faster. And if, you know, in our case, if you could three-quarter court press and do those sorts of things to get people on real low shot clocks on a regular basis. But if you can't execute or, more importantly, score in transition like you talked about earlier, you're probably in trouble.
Yeah, it's really, you know, you have to go back from the history of basketball. That's kind of where I understand why things have changed. And, you know, John Wooden was the first great coach who had a great team. And Wooden went to a 2-2-1 three-quarter press to speed the game up so people wouldn't hold the basketball on him. And then the next time the game was sped up was Rick Pitino at Providence because he didn't have the talent that they had at Georgetown and St. John's and Syracuse. So he sped the game up with his little runs and shot the three. So, but I believe that, you know, them turning the clock back only to 14 in FIBA, I don't think it really hurts. The issue at the end of the day is if you have a non-talented guy get an offensive rebound, he's still a non-talented guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So, you know, it becomes a bigger issue that, yeah, you got the offensive rebound. It's one of the things that I was in an argument with a guy about a player that he was a monster offensive rebound. I was assistant coach. He's like, well, you know, he's getting 5 offensive rebounds a game. And I, yes, stat him out. He gets the offensive rebound, and they block his shot every time. So, you know, I think on the exterior, it looks like you know, they're trying to speed the game up. But the only thing that speeds the game up in FIBA basketball is your ability to purely shoot the basketball. And without that ability, you are stuck like Chuck. Because shooting the basketball avoids all the evils of a low possession game. And I think that was the biggest failure. Canada talks about its athletes and it's coming on, but the athletes can't shoot. There's no advantage in a FIBA game for you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Canada basketball is probably right now 25, 26, 27 in the world. And the reason for that is that they're fundamentally, Canadians do not shoot the basketball. They are not great shooters.
Yeah.
And the reason is the structure in Canada is very tough. You got to get a permit for practice. Well, the kids may practice in four different gyms in a week. You know, my high school, I mean, I practiced in it from the time I was a freshman, 14 years old, till I graduated.
That's true. It's very true. When I coached at the high school level, I was fortunate to coach a kid named Tyson Dorsey, and they actually gave him a key to the school. And in the summer, his dad would drop him off on his way to work, and he would do drills and shoot all day long, and his dad would pick him up on the way home from work.
Yeah.
And he ended up getting a scholarship at Samford University, but he was second in the entire NCAA in three-point field goal percentage behind J.J. Redick his senior year.
Yeah.
And it was because he shot the damn ball all summer long, every day, hour after hour.
In the same place.
Yes.
So he was able to build a rhythm. But when I look at, you know, from grassroots, none of these teams have two guys that can shoot the basketball and make 8 out of 10 shots in a game. So, you know, the revolution needs to come in Canada is one of shooting. If you're going to be good in FIBA, you need to be able to press, get more possessions, and catch and make shots.
So let's transist a little bit here. You talked, you said, if I coached again. Let's talk a little bit about the Canadian Basketball League. I think you're still trying to get that on the go here. And if you did, would coaching be a part of what you'd be involved in, or is it strictly from an administrative and running the league standpoint?
It'd be strictly from an administrative standpoint.
Okay. So how is that venture?
Until we hired a commissioner.
Okay. How's that venture going?
It's good. We finally got the final permits from your employer at Mohawk. So we've got four facilities for four teams signed up with the permits. Insurance is in place. We've been out since last April on evaluating players in the U.S., starting with the Portsmouth Invitational. So we're headed in the right place. We're building out. We have a TV contract with Yes TV, which is local there in the Hamilton-Burlington area, to play on Saturday nights from 8 to 10. And things are moving forward. I got a couple old friends coming in town on Monday to help us with some meetings that played for me. So we're moving forward.
So where are your four cities in? Tell everybody that.
We're going to play Hamilton at Mohawk. We're going to play, Scarborough team's going to play in the new Pan Am Center. Durham team's going to play at Durham College. And a Western Ontario team will play at Guelph.
And when do you hope to be up and running?
The first game, December 9th in Mohawk.
And who right now, do you have coaches in place for those teams? Can you announce, or have you announced that?
No, we have not. We've got two coaches, and I've got to hire two more coaches.
Why don't you just do it yourself?
Then I still have to hire one coach. I still have a lot to do, and I still have a lot to do, and I look forward to it.
Are you itching to coach, though?
I just like being around young people that want to try to improve their life. You know, I mean, you know, the NBA has me speak to the teams in the summer league. And, you know, I've got three guys that I found developed. They've made $400 million. Their lives are drastically changed. And that's what I'm really good at. Now someone has asked me to, you know, let's put this thing together because country, we're the largest country in the world, but doesn't have a FIBA league. So, you know, it's taken me 2 years to do it. But, you know, if you look at my record everywhere, it takes me 2 years to get everything done.
Yeah. I would bet on you in the second year all the time. Yeah.
So, you know, most people who, you know, have not paid attention to my career would understand it, but, you know, just some, if you look at me in the second year, it's kind of, you know, it may not look real pretty the first year, but the second year we come back and raise some sand.
So you guys are going to play FIBA then?
Yes, we are.
Okay, that's interesting. And the choice for that was to help develop the local game too, or just because you like the game better, or?
I believe you can develop players better in a 40-minute FIBA game. Because if you're going to develop young players, you need to develop them on skill and intelligence. So if you go to the next level and you've learned to be effective shooting, dribbling, and smarter, the game should be easier. But if no one's giving you that skill development and that IQ, that higher IQ you need, then you're going to struggle. And, you know, I've seen it, you know, again, my career started, you know, as at Indiana in 76, but I've seen it over and over again where everyone raves about this guy's ability, but, you know, he never got a coach that really explained to him, like, hey, you got to be good in transition. You got to make shots. You got to have a crossover. And you got to be able to make a layup with your opposite hand. And the reality is that that's not a whole lot. But a lot of young players get stuck with coaches. You know, these guys get stuck with coaches that have never been to five basketball clinics.
Right. What rules are in place for, like, how many Canadians you have to have, or?
The teams, we want four for the first year, and then we'll let the Canadians unionize, and then we'll try to negotiate where we eventually get to six. See, all the European FIBA leagues are naturalized. You know, the Greeks and Italians were the first one that they seen the Americans come and said, heck with this, they unionized. Like the CFL, and said, you know, no, we got some rules to protect some jobs for the locals.
Right.
And so, you know, I believe that's the way it should go. That will strengthen the league. And now with the FIBA qualification term is changing, where there's one in February and November, you know, Canada basketball's job just got a lot tougher, almost impossible if we don't have a FIBA rules league at home.
Right. Do you think I don't know how, I'm sure you're aware, but there's the prep school phenomenon where a lot of our players were headed south at an early age seems to have the potential to be stemmed slightly in the fact that there are more prep schools now starting up here in Ontario in particular, and they're having their own league as well. So the competition level is a little bit higher. But do you think that'll have an effect on growing the game at home?
No, because the prep school is directly related to the NCAA changing the rules, where a young man now must have six semesters at one school to be eligible with his test score. So this whole thing of moving the kids around to two or three schools is out. Right. And regardless of, you know, you can have a prep school, but you can have the wrong guy coaching. So if you took the list of the head coaches on those prep schools, where have they ever coached? Yeah. So, yeah, there's a phenomenon of people, you know, doing these prep schools, but there's no phenomena that there's going to be a bunch of great coaches who are going to, you know, coach here and then move up to the NCAA and become head coaches. Okay. So, you know, the great resources normally know better than the trainer that trains them.
And who trained you? Who'd you learn from in the coaching standpoint?
I think, like, the breakdown of film, there's two, like, at Indiana Knight would break down a film after the game, when he was the most intense, and it makes you remember all the dumb stuff. And then I always did that, but then when O'Brien had this chart that was offensive plus defensive minus, because you can actually go through that chart by time and score in a game. So when you talk to the player the next day, you can actually tell him where he was standing, what time it was, first quarter, first half, second half, first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. And I just learned with filming practice and using that chart that I was always talking to the guys factually about what was going on. And so it eliminates a lot of ambiguity. So, you know, I could take, if we've seen a guy on film having three or four bad days of practice, we could take his five best practices, say, hey, here's your five best days, and here's the last 3 days, what's going on? And be able to work him back to a positive situation.
So would O'Brien, for you then, be the biggest coaching mentor you would have?
No. It's still in my mind, John Wooden. I wanted to play at UCLA. When I grew up, the Bruins were undefeated. Kareem, Wicks, it was just, they just played special basketball. And Wooden's demeanor was special. But he was a strong tactician. And he tried to get his coaching done before the game. And he sat there with that rolled up program. He had some Hall of Fame centers, so that helps.
They weren't bad.
But I think that me, I'm emotionally detached from the game. You know, let me just run through some things I've learned from, you know, like, so I was at a clinic with Dean Smith, and Dean Smith said that one of the most important things he has is someone keep track of the running score in a game. So in other words, you're going along the game, coach, and you know this, and coach, a team will go on a run. You call timeout or, you know, there's a dead ball, and then we would keep track of, okay, once that dead ball or that timeout, what's the run after that? So as a head coach in the NBA, if the run was 8-0, it was an automatic 20-second timeout. If we came out of that timeout and the other team went 4-0 for a 12-0 run, then it was automatic full timeout. So what happens is that I'm evaluating, when we scrimmage in practice, I'm evaluating how far can my first team come back from being down. So you don't put them in an impossible situation. So you don't let them lose. The other thing is before the game, on game day, I would always get on the treadmill and do 3 miles. And that 3 miles was to take the edge off of me so that I wouldn't be emotional and make stupid decisions, emotional decisions. It let me be calm, and I could calculate exactly what I needed to calculate and what was going on in the game.
See, that's, I think, if I was evaluating myself, I think that's one of my strengths, is that I can kind of detach myself and not get too emotional. But I think, I don't know if you know anyone else who does this, but I actually don't talk to my team after games just for that specific reason. I want to be able to process, walk away, and really be able to address them properly the next day as to what exactly I saw, pluses, minuses, whatever, without just going in and giving the same old, oh, we didn't work hard enough tonight, or we didn't, you know, the generic old stuff without facts.
Right. I just think, I think as a human being, the closer you can get to communicating with your team factually and honestly, you're going to help them grow as young men. And that's as much as coaching as the X's and O's.
I've taken up a bunch of your time. I want to ask you a couple more quick things before we get out of here. Number one, and this is unrelated to anything we've talked about, but I have to bring it up.
Yeah.
On your one Indiana team, you played with Randy Whitson, Mike Woodson, Glenn Grunwald, yourself, Isaiah Thomas. Five guys from the same university team ended up as NBA head coaches, or in Grunwald's case, and Isaiah, I guess, a general manager in the NBA. Like, how cerebral a team was that? Were there fights over leadership? Was everybody drawing plays up? And like, did you see that in everybody that you played with there?
No, I mean, the whole Grunwald was the most cerebral. Grunwald and I are in the same class, and Woodson, we're in the same class. And unfortunately, the summer before we get to campus, Glenn tears his knee up. But Grunwald was a perennial first-team parade All-American. 6'9", could shoot it smooth as silk, play with both hands, huge IQ, and we never got to see the benefits of that. That team that we were on should have won a national championship if Grunwald was healthy, because he was just one heck of a player. In that system, he would have been a beast.
Did Knight have to tell you guys anything twice? I mean, that's a pretty... You got five pretty smart guys there.
That's just his personality. But, yeah, he tells at least one or two things twice.
I guess you wouldn't want to be told twice, right?
Well, the issue was we learned not to listen to him.
Okay.
So that was one of the quickest things. Like, you know, this guy, when he goes crazy, I'm not listening to that chunk. I mean, you know, the people that raised me better than that. So I think all the guys had really good families but we really didn't run into each other. Whitman gets hurt, breaks his ankle, has to redshirt. Woodson slips a disc in his back, wasn't available most of the senior year. So then I was running around with Isaiah Thomas, Jimmy Thomas. So I was the old dog and they were the young dogs, and that was fine. So playing basketball and getting an education in Bloomington, Indiana was fun.
And then let's fast forward all the way to the Raptor days. Do you have one story you'd share with us, the Vince and Tracy days, that would interest anybody? I'm putting you on the spot here.
So the U.S. Olympic team had just been announced, and we were playing. We were at home, and Milwaukee was coming in. So he's still not happy with me about this. So you know, you put the starting five up on the board.
Yeah.
So we had Milwaukee starting five up, and so when my assistant coach went to put ours up, I told him don't put anyone guarding Ray Allen. I said just don't do it. So then they're going through the names, and so to remove my voice, the assistant coaches alternated on the game. So they were going through, you know, this is game plan. They're going through, you know, their play sets, and then when they got to the starting lineup, there was no one on Ray Allen. And Oakley said, like, well, who the hell's guarding Ray Allen? And I said, well, don't even worry about it. That guy, he's not even good enough to play for his own country. So I think Vince had 35 points at halftime. And we were going up the tunnel, and someone was pulling on my coat. Like, turn around, it was Oak. He said, Coach, I think you need to leave Vince alone. So that was just one of those people always say to me, why did Vince play so different? Like, I just learned that if I could get him excited, then he just took off. You know, he was just one of those guys in the locker room that I had to get, you know, I had to do things to get him excited. But once I did, like, I wouldn't have to say anything else in the rest of the game.
Well, and from an outsider's standpoint, just watching the career, I mean, I don't think anybody got more out of him than you did. I mean, he just not the same wherever else he went, but or anyone else he played for. I mean, I think it would have been interesting to see if you were able to be with that group for another couple more years.
Then I'd probably still be coaching.
Yeah, that's funny how that works, eh? All right, well, you know what? We've got one little thing that we do at the end of every podcast, and we call it the full court press. I'm going to give you some small questions here, and I just want like one word or very short answers for them.
Mm-hmm.
You ready to go?
Yep.
All right, you prefer offense or defense?
Both.
What's your favorite visiting arena or gym to have played or coached in?
Madison Square Garden.
Hardest working player you ever poached?
Doug Christie.
Highest IQ on any player you've ever coached?
Charles Oakley.
Best coach you ever played for?
Pat Riley.
If you're up 3, 5 seconds to go in the game and your opponent has the ball, are you going to you gonna foul?
Yes, every time.
I'm with you every time as well. Analytics guy, there you go. Down 1, 5 seconds left, anyone in the world, past or present, who you drawing the play up for?
I don't think Vince Carter ever missed again the game shot when I coached.
If you could spend one day as an assistant to any coach, past or present, and in any sport, who would you sit on a bench with?
Very good question. Can I pick one in football and one in basketball?
Sure.
It would be Tom Landry for the Dallas Cowboys. He was the first industrial engineer that became a head coach. And I'm really intrigued by, I think, Rick Carlisle in the Dallas Mavericks is a very good coach. He's a better coach than his talent.
What do you enjoy watching more, NBA or college?
I don't watch much of either one, to be honest with you. The last, 16 years, I really have. I enjoy the Blue Jays, Friday night football, and CFL. And I do like SEC football. It's bigger, it's faster, they're meaner.
I would agree with that. But it's nice to see you're not just living in Toronto, your roots, when you start mentioning the CFL and the Blue Jays. Good for you.
Yes. This Friday night football is just part of, always try to get up to the cottage early and make sure the beer is cold and the rocker's working and Friday night football's on.
Well, it sounds good. I'm with you there. I'm a big football fan in general. And I'm a very big Blue Jays fan, and we happen to be recording this about 15 minutes before they're going to first pitch in Seattle here, so we should probably let you go. I've taken up too much of your time already. I wish you all the best with the Canadian Basketball League, and December the 9th in our gym at Mohawk, we'll look forward to the start and the tip of that, not just the season, but that league. And I again, thank you very much for joining me here tonight.
No problem, Coach. And Coach, if you need a scrimmage, I probably got a team that would love to scrimmage you.
All right. I'll get a hold of you.
Okay.
My guys are so damn young, man. This is going to be a fun season. By the end of the year, we're going to be good, but we're really young. So,
Coach, you got to start somewhere. You've always done a good job with them. And, just like anything, man, you got to put some sunshine on them, man. Let them grow.
That's right. All right. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it, and we'll definitely be in touch.
Take care.
All right. You too.
Yep. Bye. Bye.
There you have it. In the beginning of this episode, I teased some of the crazy analytics Coach Carter was going to talk about, but my favorite quote from the interview is this: as a human being, the closer you get to communicating with your team factually and honestly, you're going to help them grow as young men. That's as much about coaching as the X's and O's. I love it. If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate if you could rate us on iTunes. It really does help others find us. Or you can share this page, coachcallstimeout.com/15, with someone who may be interested. We are a resource built to help basketball coaches get better. If you're interested in what we do at Coach Calls Timeout, we do more than just this podcast. You can go to coachcallstimeout.com to learn more. There's a free 7-day trial of our membership program you can take advantage of as a podcast listener. Just use the coupon code PODCAST when you're signing up. We currently have over 100 video plays and drills available for all game situations, ages, and skill levels, and we're adding more videos every month for our members. Our next episode is with the head coach of the men's basketball team at Ryerson University, Roy Rana. Coach Rana has steadily improved the program each year as the head coach at Ryerson, and now the Rams are a perennial national power knocking at the championship door. He's also doing great things with the Canadian National Junior Program. I'm sure the stories and experiences he shares with us will provide insight and help improve our basketball journeys. Thanks, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.